Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. A majority of Massachusetts residents oppose a sweeping set of cuts proposed by the MBTA, that according to a new Mass Inc. poll. The proposed transit cuts, which are up for a vote on December 14th and could save the system about $130 million, include, among other things, ending commuter rail service after 9 p.m. and on weekends, closing 6 commuter rail stations, ending ferry service, and cutting 25 bus routes. MBTA General Manager Steve Poftek is with us now and is taking your questions and thoughts about the T. The number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK, and you can tweet us at Radio Boston. Steve Poftek, welcome back to the show. Glad to have you.
Thanks for having me.
So, Steve, I know you're aware of these Mass Inc. numbers, and you've been holding public hearings on these proposed cuts for a while now. Do the numbers track with what you've been hearing in these feedback sessions?
Yes, and I mean, I think these feedback sessions were meant to elicit areas where perhaps we've missed something, where perhaps our analysis, has overlooked. So we've gotten lots of feedback. We did the last session last night. I was there from 6 to 8, and got a lot of great testimony from people across the service area.
So to your point, you said they were in part to elicit areas where you might have missed something. Have you missed something? Did you hear that in these hearings? And what will you do?
We are currently in the process of analyzing everything we heard, not only at the feedback sessions, but we also have an online form, which if you'll allow me, I'll plug it. It's mbta.com/forgingahead, where you can go online and give an opinion and also learn more about the proposal and how it might impact you. We're in the process of analyzing that, and we will be making some revisions to the package that we will be presenting to the Fiscal and Management Control Board on Monday at Monday's meeting.
You know, I mentioned at the top, Steve, that this is an attempt to save about $130 million through these cuts. The budget shortfall is in the $575 million range. Clearly, you're hearing people do not want the T to cut service. But is this a rock and a hard place? Do riders want something that the T can actually do?
You know, we don't want to cut service either. However, right now we have we have a number of services which have very low ridership, and I think we have places where we are probably oversupplying service for the time being. I think it's also important to emphasize that yes, there is a right now what we estimate to be a $575 million deficit. And service reductions is the last place we looked. We have reallocated a significant amount of money from the capital budget. We've also gotten what we believe is at least $140 million in savings internal to the MBTA that won't affect customer-facing service. So looking at service reductions is really the last place we've gone.
Did you ask the legislature for more revenues, or did you ask the governor to consider more revenues? And if not, is that something that's on the table now, given the level of pushback you're getting about the cuts, Steve?
There is incremental revenue in the budget. It is a one-time amount, roughly $40 million from sales tax acceleration. I think we're mindful of the fact that among public institutions at the state and local level, we benefited from $827 million in federal aid. And obviously, there's a lot of public entities that need assistance right now. So, our position is obviously we would accept any money that was available. But no, we are not formally asking.
We are talking to MBTA General Manager Steve Poftek, who is taking your calls at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Let's go to the phones. We've got Jessica on the line from Peabody. Jessica, go ahead.
Hi, yes. I'm calling with a comment more than a question. I'm a theater teacher here in the Commonwealth and actually moved back from the West Coast to the East Coast for grad school. And one of the only ways I could afford grad school was that I was staying with family outside of the city and took the commuter rail in on a regular basis. And on multiple occasions, often many times a week, would take that last Haverhill line home well past 9 o'clock simply because of my class or rehearsal schedule. So hearing that that is one of the line, you know, services being cut is really disappointing for me because it helped me have the future that I currently have. Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Jessica. Steve, let me let you respond to that.
Yeah, I mean, it's helpful to hear. I think, you know, again, we view the vast majority of these cuts as temporary, and we'll seek to restore them when we feel ridership warrants. You know, right now, I think with the pandemic, there is less activity in the evening in Boston. There are not the types of major events that would that we think would warrant ridership. And I think when those events come back, that is when we will start looking at restoring service when we have the ridership and the revenue to support it.
Steve, you know, that kind of raises a question around, one of the MassInc numbers said that more than 50% of the respondents didn't have faith that any cuts that you made, you have said they'll be temporary, but didn't have faith that those cuts wouldn't be permanent. I do understand that concern about inertia. I mean, it's that concept that once something is in a particular status, it stays that way. And it does seem like it might be hard to ramp things back up when workers are gone and capacity has been furloughed. How do you help people feel confident that these cuts could be brought back online and would in fact be temporary as the economy begins to recover? I do understand people thinking, boy, that is easier said than done.
Yeah, and I do think it's important to, you know, that we are, you know, previous to this pandemic, we were working to figure out ways that we could redesign the bus system and provision more bus service to people. We're still in the process of installing bus infrastructure so that we can increase capacity in certain corridors in the long run. And we've invested $1.7 billion last year. We hope to do about the same amount this year. So we continue to invest in the MBTA. And we do, you know, for the vast majority of these services, we do intend to bring them back again when the ridership and revenue is there. I don't think, you know, at this point, we do have services that are not being utilized that much, and we don't think it makes sense to spend the money now when we're going to need the money later. In terms of the planning for, you know, how you bring these services back, that's something we're working on right now to try to build as much resilience into the system as we can. It's not a simple thing to pull service back and a simple thing to turn it back on. So we're thinking very hard about how do we do it in a way that we can be responsive when ridership and revenue returns.
All right, Steve, lots of calls. Just quickly before I go to the phone, listeners, General Manager Steve Poftak gave a website earlier where you could provide response and input. We will put the link to that website or have put it up on our website, which is radioboston.org. So that is there and available to you. Let me go back to the phones. We've got Carlos on the line from Hull. Carlos, go ahead.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead, Carlos. Yes, go ahead.
Hi, thank you. First of all, I really appreciate all the hard work that the MBTA is doing to prevent these cuts and do the right thing. I live in Hull, Massachusetts. I am a public school teacher in Boston. I use the ferry to get to work. Obviously, we are now into remote learning, but eventually, hopefully, soon we'll be back at work. I moved to Hull basically because I was able to afford a home and also had easy access to Boston. The ferry is not only a way to get to work, but it's also an economic lifeline to the town. And I was just wondering if the MBTA is considering into their calculations the economic impact of the communities in which the services are being considered to be discontinued. Thank you.
Thank you, Carlos. Steve, go ahead.
No, I again appreciate the comment from Carlos. Obviously, we heard throughout this process, we've heard from a lot of people in Hull. You know, I think the point they've made is that the elimination of the ferry service, which we our proposal included the suspension of the ferry service, as well as the elimination of the 714 bus that serves Hull, leaves Hull without any service within their borders. There is a train station in Hingham, but again, it's not, you know, it's not walking distance to the vast majority of folks from Hull. So that is one of the, you know, one of the many comments that we've been considering, and that, you know, that theme, not only in our regional meetings, but in our system-wide meetings, was something we heard a great deal from the residents of that community.
Steve, do you have a chicken and an egg problem here? There's good news about a vaccine hopefully coming. We're now hearing fairly quickly. In fact, we're going to talk about that later in the show. So we are at a point where we can be thinking about an economic recovery as hopefully we get to a vaccinated herd immunity. Temporary service cutbacks in response to lower ridership. But if ridership needs to go up, but the services are cut back, then do you have a, you know, sort of a suppression problem there? How do you not have the cutbacks depress ridership and economic development if the response to the cutbacks is when we get more riders, we'll grow again? Do you understand my question?
I do. Right now we have a situation where we have 25% ridership and we have essentially 100% service. And I do think as people, you know, as even under the changes that we're talking about, like for instance on bus, we'd still be running 85% of our pre-COVID service. So we would still have a significant amount of service out there. I think we're thinking about how to be responsive to potential increases in ridership. I think one of the puzzles, and perhaps I should listen to the next segment to learn more about vaccines, but I think judging how ridership will come back, I think from all the modeling we've done, and we've also used a bunch of third parties, is that ridership will come back incrementally. It is not kind of a binary inflection point type event where all of a sudden ridership comes back all at once. So we've done some modeling around this. We've done some scenario planning, and that will help us. But obviously we will update that as the facts on the ground dictate.
Now, I'm going to go back to the phones in a minute, but I do want to ask you one other question on equity and cuts before we do that. You know, you have said that you used data to inform these cuts to keep equity in mind. You've said, you know, the steepest of the cuts were in areas that were the most underutilized. We've heard transportation advocates like Mella Miles, who I know you know, raise real concerns about essential workers, low-income workers, Black and brown riders, and how they're going to be affected by bus line cuts, service reduction, et cetera. I'm just going to ask you to address that head on. What the concerns are, do you see validity to some of those concerns, and how are you thinking about that?
Sure. And, the foundation that we did this analysis on was how do we preserve essential services? And we thought about this across two dimensions. One, making sure we preserve the services that serve transit-critical populations. So that's low-income communities, communities of color, places with very low car ownership where people are really dependent on transit, and also places where we're seeing high ridership or there's high propensity to return. And again, the places where we're seeing high ridership are closely correlated with essential workers, people who are traveling to work now, who aren't able to work from home. And those are the services that we've preserved. I think we've heard from the advocacy community that there are other services where, you know, it may not on a map sort of map out as a transit critical area, but people may be traveling there. And some of the changes we've made in the span of service may impact those employees. One of the places we've thought about it proactively, for instance, is we've proposed moving, having the subway close at midnight as opposed to 1 a.m., but we didn't change the opening time. We continue to open the subway at 5 a.m. because we see that we have close to COVID, pre-COVID levels of ridership, because I think that correlates with folks who are working both in the healthcare and service industries. So one of the things we are going to look at is what did the changes in span of service, how does that impact folks who are either working in the service industry, working in the hospitality industry? That is one of the comments we heard, and it is one of the things we're going to consider.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got Charles on the line from Roslindale. Go ahead, Charles.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. My question is, is this deficit issue here something that's going to resurrect itself if advocates of free ridership on the T prevail here? I mean, there's, 25% of the people using the T right now, and we've got tremendous deficits. What would happen if the T were free?
Thanks for that question, Charles. And I think we have another caller on a similar subject. So let's just take one more. We've got Monica from Ipswich. Monica, go ahead.
Hi there. Yes, thank you for everything you've been doing with the TIA. The stations are looking lots cleaner, and the repairs have been really terrific. I take the train from Ipswich. I love commuting by rail. I will say that we have we have a first class city, first world city, and we have a third world transit system. And it's just been neglected for so many years. And I think there isn't a city in the world where ridership, where the rail isn't supported by taxes. And I know taxes.
Let's take it back from you there,
word,
Monica. Thank you. Thank you. And I'm sorry to cut you off. I want to make sure that we've got time for MBTA General Manager Steve Poftak to answer you and the caller before you. Steve.
Sure. And I also want to add for Charles from Roslindale, the outbound bus lane is coming on Washington Street. That is in construction as we speak. To answer the question, you know, the MBTA's budget is roughly $2.3 billion. It's one of the pillars it's built on. Is close to $700 million in fare revenue. The MBTA did not charge fares. We would have to find some sort of replacement for that. So, I don't think, as a practical concern, I don't think that's a realistic goal at the current time.
So, Steve, you and I have been talking I've been on the show for a year and a half, and we've been talking for that time, and you've been on the job now for about 2 years. The T was facing serious deficit issues, serious battles inside the Commonwealth between advocates who want to raise taxes and more revenue and do more investment, and the challenges around, infrastructure, the capital repairs you want to do, et cetera. As with so many things, it feels like this virus has exacerbated issues of infrastructure and disinvestment. How do you think about a vision to move forward that addresses this immediate situation, but also grows our public transit into the kind of system we need for a burgeoning economy 2, 3, 4 years out, 10 years out?
Well, I think one of the things we've been able to do during this crisis is take advantage of it to make more investments in the system. We've been much more aggressive than we had originally planned, even in January of this year, much more aggressive in terms of shutting down parts of the system for longer periods of time so that we can get more work done. And I think one of the great outcomes of that is we were finally able to spend $1.7 billion. So we still have a vision to invest $8 billion in this system over the next 5 years. And I think people are starting to see the results of that. I don't think, it can't come fast enough for me, and I know it can't come fast enough for your listeners, but we are continuing to invest. We clearly have to work our way through what is a major fiscal crisis, and it is a crisis that is affecting every transit authority across the country. It's not an MBTA issue. It's a transit industry issue. We have to work our way through this, but I do believe we are going to make great investments in this system and, deliver on the transit system that this region deserves.
And in the shorter term, none of us imagined even a year ago, really, that we were going to be in the moment that we are in now. We are hopeful that the recovery is coming, that we've got a vaccine that we're going to be able to start distributing soon. Where are you thinking about the T being a year from now, 2 years from now? And how different is that from this time last year, what you were imagining?
I'm hopeful that we are in, full recovery mode. But again, I think it is going to be dictated by, items outside my control. And I'm not the person you should talk to about, how quickly will vaccines be distributed? How will they you know, how confident will people, you take care of that next. But I think that, you know, we're dependent on that, I think, as is much of this economy. I'm hopeful and I'm optimistic that we will be in recovery mode and back in growth mode. But there's a couple big pieces of this that we don't control.
That is MBTA General Manager Steve Poftek. Steve, we left the lines full, so I hope you will come back again soon and engage with us and our listeners again.
Would love to. Thanks for having me on.
Governor Charlie Baker sounded coronavirus alarm bells anew today after the state reported a record-breaking 4,600 new coronavirus cases yesterday. Here he is speaking at the Field Hospital at the DCU Center in Worcester.
Obviously, the numbers that were reported yesterday indicate that we have community transmission across the Commonwealth, and it's incumbent on all of us to recognize and understand that and to do the things that we need to do to keep ourselves, our loved ones, and our coworkers as safe as we possibly can.
Now, that even as the Commonwealth might have its first shipment of vaccine doses in less than 2 weeks. So here to talk about the state's capacity to deal with both the rising cases and how to distribute a vaccine is Dr. David Rossman, president of the Massachusetts Medical Society. Dr. Rossman, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks so much for having me. It's good to be here.
So I'm going to actually start by reading one of your tweets, and this was after we found out about the case level yesterday. You said, quote, "Hey, Massachusetts, are you paying attention? 4,613 new patients with COVID diagnosed today. You know when we last had a number like that? Never, not even close," end quote. And then you ended the tweet with the hashtag stay home. That is concerning, right? The numbers are concerning. You hitting it that hard, given your position and your perspective, is concerning. I want to ask you, do we have the healthcare capacity that we need to deal with the size of the surge we are experiencing?
It's an important moment right now that we're in, and 4,600 cases yesterday, newly diagnosed, that is certainly concerning, as you say, and it's growing fast. And if we look at the data and trying to compare the number of cases being diagnosed now to being diagnosed in March or April, it's difficult because the state has done a good job in getting much more testing available than we had then. And so we're doing, you know, over 100,000 tests a day, whereas back in March and April, we were doing a tiny fraction of that. On the other hand, the truth is there's just as much COVID and probably more COVID in Massachusetts than there was back in March and April. And the way to know that is to look at the wastewater data. When we flush the toilets, it doesn't lie. The wastewater data demonstrates that there is much more COVID now in Massachusetts than there was back in March and April. So we're at our most dangerous moment. On the bright side, I don't wish COVID on anybody, but it's younger people who have been getting it rather than older people. And although young people can get very sick, young people can die, young people can bring it to older people, especially during the holidays, it is the case that fewer of them end up in the hospital. And therefore, the hospitals have not yet been overrun. We're actually probably at one-third of the total hospital utilization by COVID that we were back in March and April. We maxed out around 4,000 cases in the hospital, and now we are under 2,000. There's room for more, but we are getting up against some very worrisome times. And I think the Commonwealth, the community, the people really need to realize what a dangerous time we're in.
You know, you're comparing and contrasting to the spring. We knew so much less then. We weren't even wearing masks at that time. And it's not any colder now than it was then. So why are we outstripping the rate of infection that we were seeing when community spread first hit us as a Commonwealth, and we knew so much less then than we know now?
Yeah, that is an excellent question. Back then we talked a lot about flattening the curve. And we did. We flattened it for a while, and the utilization of masks and social distancing had helped. You say it's not colder. It is colder. It's a nice day out today, and it's sunny, but people are spending more time inside.
it's
yeah,
becoming,
but it's not colder than it was in March and April. Well, March. Okay. I shouldn't be defensive. Sorry. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, that's true. That's true, of course. And so you're right. But when we were in March and April, people, this was new, and then people responded very quickly. And if we look back to what happened in March and April, somewhere around March 25th and 26th was the lockdown. And then the peak was around 2 weeks after, the week of April 12th. That was the highest level infection. We saw just over 3,000 cases in a single day. Again, yesterday we saw 4,600. And then it started to trend back down. There's a delay between our taking some significant action or whatever it happens, whether it's something good or bad, and the response of the virus. So when we saw a lockdown on the 25th, and we saw 2 weeks later the peak, and then it started to come down, that makes sense. And then we saw hospitalizations continue to climb for a little while because infection diagnosis has a lag of about 2 weeks from infection, and then the hospitalizations has another lag of another week or two after diagnosis.
So
we expect those lags.
Dr. Russman, that then begs the question. I mean, Governor Baker has been clear that he is not intending another big lockdown or shutdown. That, you know, the language we heard from him at the top of this segment is the same kind of thing he has been saying about the procedures we need to take for months now. Are you saying that's not enough? Are you finding yourself thinking we need to do what we did on March 25th?
No, you know, ultimately that's up to the governor. What we know is that public health measures work. People wearing masks, people keeping their distance, people washing their hands, people not going to Thanksgiving, and, you know, that's already passed, people not going and gathering during Christmas. These things are really important. We have a lot more testing capacity than we had then. The outcomes within the hospitals are substantially better than they had been then. And we know how to care for the disease better than we did then. You know, it feels like a whole different world than it did at that time. And so ultimately the decision of what to keep open and not is that's way above my pay grade. You know, what I look at is the reality that we know that it's growing. We know the public health measures that will help. And, you know, it's imploring the public to do what we know we need to, even if it's inconvenient. And I think back to your question about why things might be worse now than they were in March is, it's many months later, and people are tired of this. And there's an awful lot of COVID fatigue. People would like to see their friends, their family. They would like to gather. As it gets cold, they gather indoors. And the combination of all of those things has led to what we're seeing now.
Let's talk about the vaccine for a second. You tweeted out yesterday that you gathered from the State Department of Public Health that vaccines, some might be available as early as December 15th. You know, we've been covering on this show questions of how many people are going to be prepared to and willing to take the vaccine. And I want to ask you, in the healthcare community, you represent physicians and medical students. Do you believe your community is prepared to and will take the vaccine in the percentages and numbers that are necessary to help us get to safety?
Yeah, it's a great question and a really important one. In the healthcare community, I do. I have confidence, you know, that in the history of vaccine skepticism is long, and it's got very many different pockets. And some is the anti-vaccination belief set, and you know, science has dispelled those myths, but has not dismissed you know, the continued force there. Another is in minority Black and Brown communities. There is a deserved mistrust of the healthcare community that is longstanding from Tuskegee and beyond. And so that is something that we need to continue to work very hard to earn trust and quickly because within those communities, we need to make sure who are most vulnerable, who have known to be getting COVID at higher rates, die of it at higher rates, that they have access, easy, free, ready access to vaccines. And then within the healthcare community, you know, we're fortunate enough to understand the science, look at the science, know the science, and see the long history of vaccines as safe and effective, and that the impressive history here as well. And so I think we'll be in good shape.
That is Dr. David Rossman, who's the president of the Massachusetts Medical Society. You've been so helpful. Thanks for joining us today. I hope you'll come back.
Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
We have the head of the Commonwealth's COVID-19 Vaccine Advisory Group with us, and he is going to take your vaccine questions at 1-800-423-8255. The advisory group is responsible for helping the state develop a vaccine distribution plan, which is due to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention tomorrow. Dr. Paul Bittinger is the leader of that group and is chief of the Division of Emergency Preparedness at Massachusetts General Hospital and director of the MGH Center for Disaster Medicine. Doctor, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you so much.
So I can tell you that the calls are already starting to come in. We'll turn to them in a minute, but it's a great service for you to be with us and to be answering listener questions today. Thank you.
I appreciate the opportunity.
Oh, it's great. I mentioned this distribution plan just now. Is it finalized, and what will it look like?
So I can't speak to what has happened inside of the state for the plan. It is an update, actually, to the first draft of the plan that was submitted by the state to the CDC. And what the state now needs to do is finalize quantities to request the first allocation, which we are hoping to potentially arrive within the first couple of weeks.
And we are on track, as I understand it, to receive enough dual doses to vaccinate about 300,000 people in this first wave. Is that correct?
That's exactly right. We expect that the 300,000 doses that we've been told to expect are enough for 300,000 people and that the system will automatically order that second dose for us. So when we say 300,000 doses, we hopefully mean 300,000 people that will get vaccinated.
So Governor Baker, I'm going to play some sound for you from Tuesday when he was talking about the high-risk groups that will get first priority, healthcare workers, nursing home workers, older adults, et cetera. Here he is.
That's probably going to be where most of the activity is in December, January, February, and March. The focus is going to be on the people we are all the most worried about, either because of what they do for work or because of their age or because of their physical condition.
So a couple questions there. That, you know, that's 3.5-4 months for 300,000 people. We have a lot of people to get vaccinated over time. So how will distribution to those groups work? And is that the right kind of time frame? Is it going to take that long to get the first tranche of people vaccinated fully?
So I do think the timeline he's spelling out for the high-risk groups seems about right. But the good news is that that's many more than 300,000 doses. We expect that 300,000 number really to be the vaccine that arrives in the Commonwealth by the end of the year or very early in the first week of January. More vaccines should be coming. As your listeners likely are aware, we expect an emergency use authorization from the FDA to come first for the Pfizer product, but then only maybe a week later for another vaccine, Moderna, and having two different products really improves our vaccine availability. There are another one or two that are not too terribly far behind that, those two that we expect, and therefore the more vaccine we have, the more we can vaccinate people and get through these high-risk tranches as quickly as possible.
Dr. Paul Bittinger is the head of the COVID-19 Vaccine Advisory Group for the Commonwealth and is prepared to take your calls. 1-800-423-8255 is the number. We have Leslie on the line from Harvard, Massachusetts. Leslie, go ahead.
Yeah, hi. My question is, I know for the two vaccines, there needs to be a second vaccine with about a month later. And I was just wondering if the person doesn't come back in a month and, say, comes back in like 3 to 4 months, if you have to start the series all over again.
So that's a really good question. The two different vaccines that we are expecting, the Pfizer and the Moderna, have slightly different repeat schedules. Pfizer is 3 weeks at 21 days, or Moderna is 28 days. What we don't know yet, and we won't know until we see the ultimate document from the FDA, is what's the close window, which I think is exactly what you're asking. How long can you go if you're a little late on that second dose? In the trials, people had up to 7 days later than that end date. So for Pfizer, as an example, instead of 21, you could go out to 28. But that's just from the research trial. For most vaccines, you actually have a broader window. You can get that second vaccination later. But until we see the data from the FDA, we won't know. I'd expect it to be somewhat narrow in the order of 1 to 2 weeks. But unfortunately, I can't say more specifically yet.
What about side effects? Let's take this first 300,000 people who will be vaccinated. You know, we know some people have side effects from a flu vaccine, for example. Should we expect some percentage of folks to maybe have a fever or feel a little sick for a couple of days?
We should, and I think these issues are going to likely be more prominent, frankly, with the two vaccines we're expecting than with the flu vaccine. People like me have been trying to say for years that you can't get the flu from the flu vaccine. It's still true. But people do, as you say, have aches or fatigue after they get the flu vaccine. With these two vaccines, the side effects are a little more significant. Up to half of people, maybe even a little more, may have fatigue, muscle aches, even low-grade fevers, and those are pretty common. Within the healthcare workforce, that's going to cause some concern as we vaccinate the healthcare workforce, because those are the same symptoms of COVID that we tell people to stay out of work for. So we're going to have to be testing a lot more people as we're vaccinating in order to make sure we can do this safely.
Could that create a staffing lag, right? If you're assuming that you're vaccinating first healthcare workers who are most likely exposed to the virus in the first place, and now they're showing these kinds of side effects, and you got to test them to be sure they don't have it, is that an issue?
So it can be. Most of us are working on plans in order, because in the first 2 or 3 days after you've been vaccinated, having these predictable symptoms is almost assuredly due to the vaccine, that we think that in and of itself may not cause a staffing problem. It will cause a real demand on testing. But as many, maybe as 1 in 10 or a little bit less, may have more significant effects for a day, may feel pretty badly for a day, may need to stay home from work because they're that fatigued. And that can cause a staffing issue. We've actually been telling healthcare systems that they need to plan for that, and they frankly need to stagger their vaccinations so that, for example, not the entire intensive care unit staff gets vaccinated on one day and then the next day has staffing challenges.
Let's go back to the phones, 800-423-8255. We've got Alicia on the line from Roslindale. Hi, Alicia. What's your question?
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the vaccinations for children. I haven't heard so much about that. I know they're not quite as high on the priority list, but is anything going to be different about their vaccinations, and where are they on the priority list?
And I think we have, Dr. Bittinger, one other priority list question. So let me grab that one, too, and then you can answer both. We've got Bernadette on the line from Cambridge. Bernadette, go ahead.
Thank you very much. How high are incarcerated persons on the list of priorities of those to be vaccinated early? Thank you.
Thanks, Bernadette. Thank you. Okay, Dr. Bittinger, thanks for waiting for that.
Both are really good questions. As far as children go, the youngest trials enrolling children that we're aware of right now go down to age 12. I'm not aware of any research trial enrolling younger children. Because of the dearth of data, we don't know ultimately what the FDA is going to say, either for children between ages 12 and 18 or potentially younger. As you noted, they will be lower down in the priority list because of the risk of severe illness or disease as recommended by CDC's Advisory Committee on Immunization Practice or the National Academies. The hope is certainly research trials are ongoing, and we very much want to continue to accumulate safety data, and that will likely also inform future changes by the FDA if children aren't in the first emergency use authorization. In terms of prisoners, again, the state is considering advisory group recommendations, and so I can't say for sure within here, within the Commonwealth, but certainly the advisory group was very aware of the challenges of congregate settings overall, in certainly the long-term care facilities, which are both congregate settings and tend to have more medically frail and older residents. Those are clearly at the top of the tier, as the CDC's committee has recommended. But I would say that the advisory group strongly understands the concerns of congregate populations overall, and especially prisoners. So I would expect them to receive a substantial priority.
I'd like to grab one more call here, and then I have a few more questions of my own. We've got Craig on the line from Marshfield. Craig, go ahead.
Thank you. My wife and I are in different risk categories, and so I'll probably get the vaccination 2 or 3 months before she does. Once I'm vaccinated, assuming it takes, what are the odds of my passing it on to her despite my being vaccinated, or what are the risks? Do we still have to use the same precautions that we've done with other people?
So it's a really important question. I think two things about vaccination maybe are good to share. The vaccine, especially with the efficacy that we've heard from the studies, is very effective at preventing serious illness or death, especially in those that we think are at high risk. However, no vaccine, almost no vaccine, can prevent illness entirely. And so while community prevalence is high, which unfortunately it has been rising right now, even those who've been vaccinated have a low chance of getting infected, maybe with minimal or no symptoms, but that means you still can shed virus. You would still potentially put your partner at risk. And so it's going to be many months that public health authorities are going to be recommending people continue to take precautions, wear masks when they're in public, all the things that we've been doing. Certainly understand everyone's desire to get on the other side of this pandemic, but what we're recommending, even when one part of a household has been vaccinated, is that everyone follows the same rules until we get community prevalence down low. There is definitely an end of this road where we take our masks back off and get a lot closer to normal, but it's going to be a little more delayed than unfortunately just as soon as each individual is able to get a vaccine.
Let's talk about willingness to take the vaccine. Before the break, we talked to Dr. David Rossman of the Mass Medical Society. He expressed confidence that healthcare workers are going to be prepared to and want to take this vaccine. We have heard some concerns from some nurses unions and other groups that represent healthcare workers about kind of being in a first group to receive a vaccine that was developed unprecedentedly quickly. I noticed that CNN's reporting today that three former presidents, Clinton, Bush, and Obama, are going to take the vaccine publicly to boost confidence. Are you thinking that the Commonwealth needs to have some high-profile public vaccinations early on to inspire confidence, give the shots to some important folks who will say, hey, this is what we need to do?
I do think, obviously, vaccinating visible important figures is very important in their order of priority within the scheme. I think, you know, there are reasons people have had concerns about vaccine that I think were well stated in the previous segment. I think it's important to recognize that although the speed of scientific development was unprecedented for these vaccines, there's a lot about these research trials that are exactly the same as all the other research trials that we use to evaluate the safety and efficacy of vaccines. These trials are as large or larger as previous vaccine trials for other vaccines. They are subjected to the same statistical analysis and the same independent review and rigor. So there are a lot of reasons to have confidence in these vaccines as they are being independently evaluated by multiple different layers. I think, again, certainly one component of vaccine confidence is seeing people either who may be role models or those who really people trust as trusted messengers getting vaccine. But I think it really is going to take a multi-layered approach for us to address people's questions and make sure that they have a chance to get the answers they need.
I'm going to ask you a question that one of our callers has asked. I'm not sure I'm going to have time to go back to the phones, but I want to get this one in. We have a caller who's got a question about vitamin D deficiency and what that means for intensity of the virus, and does it affect one's ability to be responsive to the vaccine? Do you know?
So I'm not aware of data that would suggest that specific deficiency affects it, but I can't say that I know that definitively. I think for the most part, we still need to accumulate more data on which types of patients might have difficulty mounting a response. But for the most part, we think there are very few contraindications to getting vaccinated and for most people to mount an effective response.
And we've had a couple of other calls both today and other days come in where people just really want to hear, and you're the perfect person to ask this, are you feeling confident that when this vaccine comes in, it gets here, we get the doses, in December, is it safe and ready to go? Can we just begin vaccinating people?
So I do believe so, but I want to be very transparent myself that what I want, which is I think what most medical scientists want, is to get that chance to look at the data for the emergency use authorization, because that's what I do as a physician otherwise for any new drug or any new therapeutic I prescribe. I have a lot of confidence in the system that the independent data safety monitoring board, the independent vaccine and related biologic products review board, the independent advisory committee on immunization practice, and the FDA itself are all very important layers of review. Again, as I would for any other therapeutic, will look at data, but I am very confident that quickly, meaning within days of the emergency use authorization, just as the product is arriving here in Massachusetts, I will have confidence in this vaccine. And as an emergency physician, I will be very eager to receive the vaccine when it's my time in the priority list.
In listening to you, that makes me think about this question of a mandate. You know, the governor has mandated flu shots, for example, for kids to be in public schools after December 1st. He has said that he is unlikely to mandate use of the coronavirus vaccine. Are we going to be able to get to where we need to be without a mandate? And would it even be safe to consider one under the circumstances?
I guess the question to me is instead of the safe to consider, is the practical question. And for my system, the Mass General Brigham Health System, we will not be mandating it initially because it's not practical if we don't have sufficient quantities initially. So I can't mandate something I don't have enough of at the very beginning. We will reassess. We as a healthcare system do mandate the flu vaccine because of the benefits of the vaccine in protecting against asymptomatic transmission. But I think more than a mandate, really what our job is as healthcare leaders is to make sure people get answers to the questions that they have about the vaccine. I do feel that the majority of people will want this vaccine as they have confidence as they get answers to their questions. It's a little bit strange to say, but I'm encouraged by how many people really want priority in vaccine allocation. Certainly I've had a lot of outreach over the last several weeks, and I take that as a sign that people really do have trust in the vaccine and understand what it means for us getting on the other side of this pandemic.
We've got about 20, 30 seconds left with you. Anything else you want people to know about the vaccine?
I think what people need to know is that there will be multiple vaccines, and they will ultimately probably have different populations that they are most effective in. But in the history of public health, vaccines have been the single biggest intervention saving lives across the globe. This is by far our single best shot to get past this pandemic and get back to normal life. There are leaders at every level of the system who have no interest in doing anything except for delivering a safe and effective vaccine. I'm in that group, and I really think we're going to have confidence, and I cannot wait for us to look back and be so proud of how we vaccinated so many people in such a short period of time.
Dr. Paul Bittinger of the Massachusetts General Hospital and chair of the state's COVID-19 Vaccine Advisory Group, thank you so much.
Thank you.